Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Board of Health. Please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. There's two items on the consent agenda. Is there a motion to approve consent agenda items 1 and 2?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed. Motion carried. Any comments from the public? Seeing none, moving on to the public health piece. You're up.
Good morning, counselors.
Good morning.
Is gonna we discussed this, I believe, at a recent work session, and we have the ordinance ready to go. So Jeff Harbison is going to talk about it.
Yes, actually, in front of you is the ordinance that related to the work session and the Board of Health meeting. This is the scenario 4 that is not quite full cost recovery, but it's moving us in that direction. Just if there's any questions.
So that gives us full cost recovery in these categories. But does this bring us to the point where overall we're recovering cost on all fees?
It will eventually. If you remember, when we had the work session, we are adjusting in many of these categories for full cost recovery. However, in several categories, some of them were water. We did not want to see those very precipitous immediate spikes, so we're going to implement them over a longer time frame.
And so I recall that conversation. And we did not want to do too much too fast, and we wanted to make sure that we understood all the implications of doing it.
So that was the methodology that we came up with. Was it number 4
or whatever? Yeah, scenario 4 we came up with during the work session. I brought that back to a Board of Health hearing. This sets us at full cost recovery except for in drinking water and one of our on-site septic programs.
But in this methodology, we're going to bring those up more gradually.
Yes.
So that we don't hit folks with a large increase right away.
Yes. So in the big picture and overall, we are trying to trend in this direction that we, A, keep our health department costs down, departmental costs, and connected to making ends meet, so to speak, is as we identify the ability to do it, increasing fees to cover costs.
Yes.
In the big picture. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And if I also remember correctly, I think one of the driving factors was this impact on the general fund.
Yes. The approach in the past was to not do full cost recovery. It was the greater good. Essentially, for that shortfall, the general fund was making up for that shortfall. And so that's why we wanted to basically really try to to have full cost recovery, but in these two areas, we wanted to gradually implement it so it wasn't as steep or precipitous of an increase if we went to full cost recovery immediately in those two categories.
So those getting the services are paying the fees rather than the rest of the taxpayer subsidizing those fees for services.
Correct.
Individual businesses or people might be receiving from the county.
And is this full cost recovery based on, I guess, hours on the job?
It's based on full program costs, things like building rent.
Oh, in general, huh? And that's split up. The temporary permits, is that fair boost?
Well, not just the fare, but
no, but
those would be in there.
Okay, everything. What's the temporary late fee?
Temporary late fee is when there's not enough notice. I shouldn't probably try to provide the number of days, but there's a requirement of the number of days that they notify our food safety program that they're going to be up and running.
Okay. So you're not there, this afternoon, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, very good. Okay.
So some of these fees are a fee that would be sort of for a one-time situation. Some of these fees are recurring fees.
Yes.
So the notification to the users about a fee increase, are we going to wait just until a billing cycle and have them call us and say, this can't be right?
Right. I believe our Environmental Public Health Department unit is working on a communication strategy.
Good. I see nods, so we are working on that. And it's just a good idea to let people know in as much advance as we can so that we're not deluged with angry people calling. A lot of times it's if it's a surprise. So thank you for that.
We have our Environmental Public Health Director, Janice Koch, here. I don't know if you have anything to add to that.
This budget been posted, right?
Yes, the budget's been submitted, so it's posted with the county budget that's being proposed.
No comments from the public?
So we brought this to our technical advisory committees, the food TAC, the solid waste advisory committee, the various TAC, the OSS TAC, on-site septic services TAC. They all understand that costs do go up. They would prefer smaller incremental fee adjustments. Going to an annual budget process, that should happen.
Oh, okay.
We were actually adjusting the fees every 2 years, and then there was a two-year span where they were not adjusted at all based on council decision.
Yeah.
Who are on these various
committees? It's usually industry. The food TAC is represented by restaurants. The on-site septic TAC is septic installers, designers.
So when they were talking about this fee being incremental, were they addressing what was happening here, that they would have preferred that it was a slower increase, or?
The one that was most vocal is actually one that we're not going to full cost on.
Okay.
That's the on-site septic TAC.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons we came up with that alternative.
That's what I understood, that we were trying not to impact mainly individual homeowners, for instance, that are just either putting in their septic tank or have to have upkeep, or this also is these are wells, is that?
Yeah, the drinking water program is the other one that we're not going to full cost recovery on.
And
I think people get that there needs to be increases over time. It's just that large increase.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, going several years and then getting hit with a large increase was not very palatable for people.
And so if I understand right, what they're asking for in the future, too, that this be more gradual and not these big hits all at one time.
I think foregoing fee increases for a full two-year budget, it stacks up 4 years worth of cost increases. And going to the annual budget process will definitely help.
I see many advantages to going to the annual budget process.
Makes it a lot easier to project your business business costs.
Exactly.
Thank you. Okay. Any other questions? Any comments from the public? Seeing none, is there a motion? We have a number?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I move that we approve Ordinance Number 2018-11-07, Environmental Public Health Fees.
Second.
I'll second it.
Call the roll, please.
Stewart.
Aye.
Olson.
Aye.
Bold.
Aye.
Irene.
Aye.
Motion carries.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Moving on to Public Health in Action, Holiday Recycling.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to have Jill Krumloff and Sally Fisher, who are going to present the topic of holiday recycling, work with Environmental Public Health.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
So today we're going to talk about holiday waste reduction. So what is holiday waste reduction? It's everything from excess packaging to wrapping paper, wasted food and trendy toys, the latest gadgets, electronics. So the consequences for indulging in so much extra stuff during the holidays is that about 25% extra waste is produced during between Thanksgiving and New Year's Day. So that equals up to about 1 million tons.
I have a question about that.
Sure.
Can we go back to that first slide? This is an important question. It's not a crazy one. What do we mean by throw away? Does that mean it ends up in a transfer station? Because like electronics, which you just raised that issue, if you have something broken and obsolete and you take it to the disposal site specifically for electronics, do we call that a throwaway?
Yes.
Okay.
So I think this 25%, as far as it was from the Ohio EPA, which I think they used from the uselessstuff.com research. So that's something that I can find out exactly, but I believe the 25% is everything. Okay, so that equals about 1 million tons extra per week. So what is Green Neighbors doing about it? We are we're working with public health, and we're kind of trying to really spread the word about holiday waste through the month of December. One of the ways is...
Be quiet.
So the holidays are right around the corner.
I just absolutely love the holidays. Going shopping at the mall and then shopping online. And my absolute favorite part is camping outside of the stores to get the deals right there in the morning. Be the first one in the store. There is nothing like it.
I'm really not a big fan of all the consumerism around the holidays. It's just really wasteful. And I am trying to be waste-free this year.
What does that mean?
So I'll make my friends gifts like spicy party nuts. I'll give them experiences like tickets to local shows. I will make charitable donations in their names to charities that I know they really care about. And when I do give them gifts, I wrap them in reusable containers. And they seem to really appreciate it a lot more than the super impersonal big box store throw it away in a week gift that I would give them otherwise.
Oh my gosh. Fancy you say that, because right now there is a 10-hour sale on flat screen TVs. I just gotta take advantage of this.
No.
Sit here?
Not at all.
What are you knitting there?
Oh, I'm knitting scarves as gifts for my friends this year.
Oh, no way! I'm making all my friends beeswax candles. Recyclersonly.com
tonight. This holiday, make memories instead of stuff. For more holiday waste reduction tips, visit recyclersonly.com.
Wow.
Don't quit your day jobs.
Yeah.
BT helped us put that together.
So you're probably familiar with the Green Neighbors website. And the site is really two different pieces to it. One is more like technical assistance, how you recycle items, where you take them, when you take them. Do you take the caps off your water bottles? That's a real popular question. And then the other side is more lifestyle. And so it's people who are interested in living a sustainable lifestyle. It gives them tips and ideas for how they can do that and how they can reduce waste in their life. We cover natural gardening, volunteer opportunities, and community events, to name a few. So if you're interested, you can check out clarkgreenneighbors.com. We also have a webpage that's completely dedicated to holiday waste reduction and gives tips for like how to wrap gifts so that you're not just wrapping it in things that end up in the garbage. And my tip for you today is please do not use any tissue paper. Tissue paper is not recyclable. And I know, I was recycling it up until like 2 months ago, and I found out that it can no longer be recycled. So that's my recycling tip of the day. We also have a green blog on that website, and we do weekly posts on current topics. We had 27,000 people read our blog posts this year, so we're pretty proud of that. That's a good number. And in the green blog, we have a series of blog posts called The Resilient Recycler, where we try to address current topics. There's been a lot of recycling stuff in the news this year, so we've tried to make that more clear for the public to understand, and we've had 11,000 people just read those posts alone. So there's definitely an interest out there. And people, I think people all really want to do the right thing. They don't always know what the right thing is, or, you know, everybody has their own definition of that. But what we would like them to do as far as recycling is all in our blog posts. Then we also have a newsletter that goes out every month, and it has news events, volunteer opportunities, and it goes out to about 7,500 people. So we're also able to incorporate some of our educational messaging into that. And we're very active on social media. We do Facebook, we do Instagram, and we work a lot with public health to try to, you know, kind of cross our posts and to work together on what we have to say.
The newsletter, does it go out by email?
It does, yes.
Thank you.
So using these outlets, some of the tips that we're giving people this year are thoughtful giving, which is giving homemade things or charitable donations, giving the gift of time and experience, things like that. Rethinking packaging, reducing wrapping paper, trying to make reusable bags. The Repair Cafe actually launched a little side project at the night market, and they were actually making gift bags for people, either with their own material or you could bring in your fabric and they would sew it for you. So it's kind of a fun thing that they did last week, and they got a write-up in the Columbian about it.
Who did that? Did you say
the Repair Cafe?
Oh, okay, yeah.
People and I believe
do the bikes and right.
Is bikes?
It bike? It's actually it's all kinds of things. Like
yeah. It just depends on what kind of fixers. They
yes,
get.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. They do bikes. So the wasted food problem, where I think it's about 33% extra food is wasted in the holidays as well. And we're just encouraging to think ahead, plan ahead, use leftovers, and compost when you can. And then finally, at the end of the holiday season, to recycle right. And we have our Recycle Right app, which is great because you can search for pretty much any item and kind of find the ways to properly dispose of it, whether it's in your curbside garbage bin or at a grocery store for plastic bags. And then we're also focusing on tree disposal.
So at the end of December, we really shift our focus to how people are going to get rid of their trees, because there's a lot of trees, and 3 out of 5 trees end up in the garbage and are at the landfill. So we really want to reduce that number if we possibly can. You know, people can they can be mulched or composted if they get to the right place, and then we can grow more trees. So we provide low-cost options to residents. We have a flyer that we give out to people, and we're trying to get those out this year to a lot of the tree lots and the farms. And there was a big event at Esther Short Park where they gave away trees. So was that
coming
last?
Up?
Oh,
December
it's coming 7th. Up.
Yeah.
Okay,
so
it's
we'll
coming up still. And so we'll have flyers there, and we're going to try to hang those on each tree so they go home. Because we do get a lot of phone calls from people wanting to know, now that Christmas is over, how do I get rid of this tree? And they, of course, they have to get rid of it the way they got it in there, but we can at least give them good information on where to take it and the best way to dispose of it. So and did we bring? We brought some flyers if you're interested in taking
it. Nice if there was some way, and this is Waste Connections, not you, but, I mean, for those, most trees are taller than 5 feet, and to have the homeowner cut it in some way is going to, and a lot of folks don't have the resources to do
yeah.
it.
Yeah, it does make it difficult.
Yeah. Is it putting it out on the curb would be the easiest thing to do for the,
and of course,
the debris, the yard debris.
Right. Yeah. And the Boy Scouts come around.
Right, exactly. They
and,
do. Yeah.
And pick up trees as well.
I noticed, too, in the previous slide with these trees that need to be cut up, that you have to, you know, a single tree in sections of 5 feet or less need to be in an empty yard debris cart.
Right. Mm-hmm.
They want only the tree. Why is that?
Well, because if you're paying for your yard debris service and you fill your cart.
Oh, because of the free part.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But you could pay for an extra
like
and put it out.
I think the other part of that is mechanically, when they try to dump that in, mm-hmm. branches can hold that inside.
Right.
So that they can be, you know, getting it to exit. Yes. The yard debris container can be a challenge.
That's a good point. It is a challenge.
It's got to be hard. Yeah.
Well, they can whack those carts pretty
just
hard.
Just get a little tree. Just get a baby tree.
Yeah. There you go. Or an artificial one. Oh, that was terrible.
Okay. You can use that year after
the calls
year.
Now.
I'll make it out of fabric. I'll sew a tree.
Very good.
There's lots of options. So to recircle back to the Recycle Right app, mm-hmm. another important aspect is that you can get your collection information on there. So if there's any service change during the winter time, you know, if they're not going to be able to pick up one day, you can get the alerts to your phone. So that's another reason why the Recycle Right app is really valuable. And we're really trying to promote that with Waste Connections and the City of Vancouver. So,
is bubble wrap recycled?
No.
I didn't think so. And the bigger stuff, the things that they blow in, that's not either, is it?
The styrofoam type, little pellets.
Drop that off, though, at certain locations. Yeah. And the bubble wrap, it's acceptable at some locations.
Oh. But kind of the interesting thing.
The tissue?
I realize cardboard is recycled, but we're having a hard time with that. But, you know, it's interesting because, you know, Amazon had their biggest day ever. So all that cardboard now is coming from Amazon, and I don't get it, but my kids get it. So, and it seems like they give you this great big box, and half of it is bubble wrap. There's a little thing inside.
There's, I think, a lot of memes about that. But I think Amazon was working toward going toward envelopes and less bulky.
Oh, really?
Apparently, though.
Those envelopes are going to, boxes. I bet, yeah. will be a little like grocery bags that can't be recycled. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They're going to be lighter weight because they have to be sturdy to a certain degree.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
You don't want things broken and then back and forth.
Right, right. Exactly.
Did you lose your box knife? You just take a big box and cut it up smaller and wrap it with twine that is biodegradable.
Good for you, Jeannie.
Yep.
Well, very good. I took away from this that if you don't buy gifts at all, you're really environmentally responsible.
Yes. Right. Well,
give them a kiss.
I've actually embraced the thoughtful giving thing, and it's not because it's because I'm too lazy and I don't like to wrap gifts. So I do give tickets and dinner stuff and things like that, just because. Yeah.
And your time is so valuable. If you can share your time with somebody, that's probably the greatest gift of all.
Well, you can also buy a gift bag.
Right. Your time.
Buy a gift bag.
Nobody mends for that.
And when people take whatever's in at home, fold it back up and save it for next year. I have some that have been through about 5 years. Mm-hmm. They're not looking that great anymore. But
I'm sorry to belabor this, but I do have a question about tissue. Why is that? Why is that not recyclable?
It's just that the paper fibers, every time you recycle paper, the fibers get a little shorter. And so by the time it gets turned into tissue paper, it's really at the end of its life. So it can't be
recycled. I see. Yeah. It can't be reused, actually.
Yeah. So fold that up, too, and put it with your gift bags and use it again. Yeah.
Yes.
Kind of like shop. Well,
gift bags are so much easier.
Yeah.
That's where all the tissue comes in. Yeah. Put it on the top to hide what's in.
Color. Okay. Okay, very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Merry Christmas.
Same to you.
Director's report. Alan has time.
Ready to switch to chicken pox? This came up at the last Board of Health meeting, so I figured I'd give you an update. And if we have no new cases today, I think we can declare the outbreak over. So So if you recall, as of October 18th, we had identified five cases at Daybreak Primary School in Battleground. And the first case was onset was October 13th. And the last known exposure at the school was October 17th. And what we did was, because we had an outbreak at the school, we issued an exclusion order, basically required the school to exclude staff and susceptible students for 21 days, because that's the incubation period. It's a time when you get it, from when you can get exposed to when you can develop the disease. We excluded folks for 21 days, but they could go back to school if they got their, if they got one shot. So we allowed that. So the school sent a notification letter out to parents notifying them about exclusion, about the exposures, and about the exclusion criteria. So when we heard from Battleground Schools on November 13th that of the families with unvaccinated children, 19 of those families, or 41 families with unvaccinated children, 19 of them, those families chose to have their children remain unvaccinated, so they were excluded for the full 21 days. But 22 either demonstrated that got the records up, produced the records that showed that children had been vaccinated, they had titers drawn, they had blood tests drawn to show that these kids had immunity, or they got the children the vaccine. So we're actually able, not that the idea of exclusion was to raise immunization rates, but we did get more kids did become vaccinated as a result of that exclusion order, and they were able to go back to school. All the staff members, school staff members, were compliant with requirements to demonstrate immunity, and they returned, they were not excluded. So the good news is we declare an outbreak over when we've gone two incubation periods after the last case. So we'll be 42 days after the last case as of today. So if we don't have any new onsets, we can declare the outbreak over. The other point I want to make about that is one of the reasons for excluding kids at the beginning for the 21 days is not only to prevent immediate cases, but these outbreaks can go on for a long period of time, and getting more kids immunized at the beginning can actually help several months down the line, because now we have more immune kids. So I'm happy that there have been no more cases and that we should be able to declare this outbreak over. It really is disruptive to the school, plus chickenpox can have some nasty complications. So I don't know if you have any questions about chickenpox or...
Questions about how many of the unimmunized kids got chickenpox? Do you know that?
I do know that. I probably don't want to say, because the numbers are really small,
okay.
I don't want to provide that information, because
okay.
It's like information about the individual children.
But I guess then I would make a general question. Were they the majority of the group that got chickenpox?
I believe so, yes. And the other point I want to make is that one shot for chickenpox is 85% effective, and I believe two shots is about 98% effective. So immunization is very effective. And in general, these cases, unimmunized children are much more at risk. And I'm sorry, you know, don't...
I understand completely.
Very good. Okay.
Be careful about those questions.
Yeah. Flu update?
Flu update. So you can get this off of our website. I just, I'm going to be bringing this up now every Board of Health meeting for the next several months, probably. But we're at, let's see if I can find my update here. I'm looking at the wrong piece of paper. Here we go. It is on our website. We determine whether we're in flu season by the percentage of lab tests that are positive. So once we get above the 10% threshold, where 10% of specimens are positive, we declare that we have elevated flu activity in the community. Right now, we're at 2.4%. So this is just a brief update to say that we're still well below the levels. That being said, and actually Washington is, Washington we're below 10%, the entire state. That being said, this can change pretty quickly, and it takes 2 weeks to develop full immunity after getting the shot. So it's not too late for anybody to get the flu shot now. And I can't predict how bad I know I'm saying this repeatedly, but it's just an opportunity since we're the Board of Health here to get that message out.
It's good.
I had some data from past years here, and in Clark County, in last season we had 15 deaths, and the year before we had 26 deaths, and we had outbreaks. 2 years ago we had 20 outbreaks in long-term care facilities. Last year we had 13. So the other point is to get immunized, not only to protect yourself, but protect the vulnerable folks around us, including the elderly. So anybody 6 months or age and older basically is eligible, should get the flu vaccine.
Very good.
Okay. If anybody has any questions?
I have a question. I just saw a farm market report in Farm Bureau about romaine lettuce.
Oh, I was.
And it's interesting on there, the number of growers that hasn't been affected was, they had good product that had to throw everything out. And so the end user, the restaurant or everything, it's a go or no go for the country. But yet, the farmers and ag industry are saying, hey, in this day and age, we know where it's coming from. Don't shut the whole thing off because people are going to go broke.
So I'm glad you brought this up. Our response to this kind of stuff is only as strong as our public health system is.
Right.
And the problem is when you have mass production, a lot of things get mixed with each other. You have broad distribution. It's unlike and. Actually, another reason for having local agriculture, because when you have local agriculture, we support local agriculture, you have much more narrow bandwidth in terms of risk.
We have local people here, and because of this go or no go, even the local stuff is.
They got caught up in it.
Yeah.
Right. So my other point is, in terms of the public health system, so once things like this happen, our epidemiologists get to work, and we start looking at, investigating cases, trying to do trace back to, and we can spend a lot of time, and maybe we should do a Board of Health session one about how we do trace back and how we look at these outbreaks. But the idea is to first find out where, who the case is, tying the cases together based on the genetics, because we do, PFGE. You've heard me talk about that.
Yeah.
Find out what they have in common, and then try to see, identify what they ate. And then if there's packaging left, try to do a trace back. The bottom line is E. coli that affected these people came from cow stool. I mean, that is where it comes from.
California.
Well, it turns out, the quicker you do the investigation, it was, I believe, Central California. But until we knew that, we were telling people to throw out romaine lettuce in general, and that's your point.
Yeah.
But the sooner we can find out, not only to protect the public, but also economically to find out. I mean, it's a shame that a whole bunch of romaine lettuce was thrown out because we were unable to, the time it took to identify where it was coming from.
And the irony of having the waste conversation when we're throwing out hundreds of thousands of pounds of lettuce.
Right.
Millions of
pounds. Yeah. So, but that's another reason for having a robust public health system that nationally
is it
underfunded.
Except Northern California.
Yes.
Except California.
Okay. Yeah. I see some places don't have it yet. So
don't have.
I don't know if they're just
romaine lettuce.
Yeah.
I think the message I heard from the CDC was that if it's unlabeled, if you can't identify where it came from, don't eat it. If it is labeled and it's not from those areas in California.
Oh,
that's a little confusing because it doesn't give the point where it came from. It's the packaging. It's the repackaging plant that is on the bottom of some of the wrappers. So it might say California, it might say somewhere else, but that's the hub. That's not necessarily where the product originated, which is confusing for consumers. So is there any way, if you get romaine or other leafy greens, is there any way for ordinary people to wash them just with chlorinated tap water?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So you can't, first of all, you could probably soak it in bleach. I don't think, and I'm not recommending that because aesthetically it's not going to work, but it really is, the problem with lettuce is it's got like all these little nooks and crannies, and I wouldn't recommend that in terms of protecting yourself. Washing it in like in bleach or something like that, I wouldn't recommend it as protection for E. coli.
Okay, so tap water has some chlorine in it.
Well, yeah, it's mostly by the time you drink it, its levels, you know, by the time it gets to the...
Well, yes, that's so we don't get poisoned, right? So I'm just wondering if for normal households, if there is a way to prudently rinse romaine that we know is relatively successful.
And my answer is, if there's any question that it was contaminated, that using water and rinsing it at the sink will not protect you sufficiently. That's the problem. It really is hard to eliminate it because of the way lettuce is. Mm-hmm. And it only takes, with E. coli, you know, 250,000 bugs can so fit on the head of a pin. It only takes as few as 10 organisms to cause problem. So I wish we had a simple way of doing this, but you can't avoid it by rinsing, you know.
What are we doing at the point of origin? So you may be able to identify a farm in California but this is a repeated problem, and I'm wondering why nobody in the country has a handle on it. So what do we do? We don't want to drive a farm out of business. I mean, if it comes from handling, or it could come from fertilizer, could it?
It comes from cow stool. So any way that cow stool gets into the
added to soil enrichment, it could come from there, right?
It could come from, yeah. I mean, I imagine it could come from irrigation water. It could come from cows. It could come from cows wandering in the...
Okay, so it would seem like there'd be a way to get a handle on this at the origination source.
And I believe that's the Department of Agriculture generally takes care. And we can get you more information on that, even if you want to hear more about how that's
done. Of all the things that infectious disease that comes into Clark County, there's been more about romaine lettuce in the last year than probably any other concern. So I'm sure every other health department has the concerns. I'd hope the feds would focus and concentrate.
Over the last, you know, it used to be in the early days of E. coli, it was beef, you know, and contaminated beef, especially ground beef. Yeah. And the industry made some changes in terms of reducing that, but now we're seeing you remember we had a spinach outbreak a few years, a national outbreak related to bagged spinach. The problem with, I mean, I'm not discouraging people to eat produce because I think it makes us all healthier. And, you know, it's not like we had millions of cases here, but the problem with produce is it's not cooked, right? I mean, you don't eat. So if it's contaminated at the source, so the broader the band of distribution and the more mixing that goes on, the higher the risk. And that's what I was talking about having local agriculture. It's much narrower band. Very fewer people are at risk if we can, you know, we can do more of that. But it really is controlling it at the origin. And that's, you know, the Department of Agriculture has a role to play in terms of that. And we can get more information for you on that.
Very good.
I can talk about this. But also having good, you know, the other point is having good traceback systems so you can see where it's coming from. And also being able to investigate these pretty rapidly. The spinach outbreak, you know, an astute epidemiologist added some questions to ask the people who had been, this is people across the country, and was able to identify bagged spinach pretty quickly. So being able to have a system that identifies what the potential exposure is really critical.
Okay, very good, thank you. Anything else?
Oh, I'm good.
Anything from the board? I was at the Public Health Advisory Committee last night, and I'll say it. You can throw things if I shouldn't say it, but I think their next thing kind of is close to trauma. Going to talk about that, suicide prevention, and I think it's kind of neat that the Youth Commission is going to be talking similar about the same thing. So it's pretty good. Well, thank you. Okay, thanks for coming. Meeting adjourned.